This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what does the outcome of Israeli parliamentary elections tell us about the direction of the Jewish state and chances for Palestinian statehood? Benjamin Netanyahu emerged victorious in the April 9 elections and is on track to be Israel's longest-serving prime minister. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The elections were widely seen as a referendum on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, also known as Bibi, who was running for an unprecedented fifth term. Despite the most formidable opposition against Netanyahu to date from the Blue and White Centrist Coalition, led by former Army Chief of Staff Benny Gantz, Netanyahu's Likud party won 36 of the 120 seats to Gantz's 35. Since Likud won the most seats of any party, Israeli President Reuven Rivlin will likely choose Netanyahu as the party leader he feels has the best chance of assembling a parliamentary majority. Bibi's re-election could have major consequences for Israel, the Palestinian territories, and the region writ large. He will most likely stitch together a coalition that depends on ultra-Orthodox and ultra-nationalist parties. This, as he is likely to face indictment on corruption charges. Israel's attorney general intends to charge the prime minister with bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, pending pre-indictment hearings that are expected over the next several months. Standing behind Netanyahu in all this has been U.S. President Donald Trump. Mr. Trump moved the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, and designated the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran as a terrorist organization. In the process, the United States and Israel have upended decades of American policy and UN Security Council resolutions, like the 1993 Oslo Peace Accord that says the borders of Israel and the future of Jerusalem would be negotiated by the two parties. Further strengthening Netanyahu's re-election prospects was the fact that the Trump administration promised to roll out its long-awaited blueprint for a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians after the election. Joining us to discuss the results and impact of the elections are two regional experts. David Makovsky is the Ziegler Distinguished Fellow and Director of the Project on Arab-Israel Relations at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. That's a think tank here in Washington. And Lucy Kurtzer-Ellenbogen. She's the Director of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict Program at the U.S. Institute of Peace. That's a U.S. federal institution tasked with promoting conflict resolution and prevention worldwide. Both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Glad to be with you.
David Makovsky, let me begin with you. What's your reaction to the results of the elections? They were close, but yet seen as a referendum on Bibi Netanyahu. How did Bibi pull this off, despite a formidable challenge from Blue and White, and also the fact that he faces possible corruption charges?
Netanyahu basically appealed to the Israelis along these lines, that life has been good in Israel, that the GDP per capita has surpassed Japan, infrastructure, trains, the standard of living, all these things have been on the upward swing, that he has made these tentative ties with Gulf Arabs, that the Palestinians are not the gatekeepers on this issue anymore, that he's done outreach in Asia and Africa, Eastern Europe, building alliances based on Israel's natural gas in the Mediterranean with Greece, Cyprus, a Mediterranean gas group, including Egypt, the gas deal with Jordan. All these things say that Israel is on the upward trajectory, and that's more about competence than it is about the probity, if you will. And also, I think, plays to something Israelis like to hear, that it's good to have friends in high places. Name me another leader in the world that has such a personal relationship with the President of the United States and also has a good working relationship with the leader of Russia. So Israelis like to hear that. And, you know, as you point in your setup, the moves by Trump on the Golan, a special humanitarian gesture done by Putin, all this speaks to the fact that Israel is more plugged in the world than ever before. And I will have my day in court on the corruption charges. I will refute these things at a hearing, but competence is what counts, and I'm working for you.
Turning to you, Lucy Kurtzer-Ellenbogen, for your take on the outcome of the elections and how Bibi pulled this off. We do have to say, though, 50%, almost 50% of the population still was willing to go with this blue and white, or not 50%, but a right. large portion. So you might want to speak to that as well.
Sure. I mean, when you look at the seats that both of those main primary contenders ended up with, again, it was pretty close. The Likud party ended up, I believe, with 36. Blue-white ended up with 35. But what you have to look at, because of the nature of Israel's politics, is it's all about the coalition building. The ruling party is going to have to build a coalition in order to gain a majority of 61 or more seats in the Knesset. And so the challenge here for Gantz was being able to bring enough parties in to get to that majority seat. And when you try to break down and analyze what these votes for the different contending parties meant, what you saw concomitantly with the blue-white future, very impressive performance given that they were a new party, is that they probably ended up peeling seats from an old standard like Labour, which is down to 6 seats in this upcoming parliament, upcoming Knesset, which is really quite remarkable. So there was some maybe cannibalization, if you want to call it, of the sort of more traditional left. That's where blue-white was gaining its seats from, rather than necessarily gaining from the right, which is what it really would have needed to be able to form a coalition. So now what you see is Netanyahu being able to most likely form probably one of the most right-leaning coalitions you'll have seen in Israel's history. But the point I make on this, to add to everything that David said, which is correct, I think the Israeli electorate, though many, including probably many who ended up voting this way, have concerns about Netanyahu. They look around, they're concerned first and foremost about security in a hostile neighborhood, and they look around and they see that Netanyahu, in the many ways that David has described, has really done quite a masterful job of keeping things relatively stable, secure, prosperous. And I think the question for many Israeli voters was, do we want to take a chance on certainly people who have proven themselves militarily, but what will they be like on the world stage, the diplomatic stage, the way that Netanyahu is able to be? And the one last point I'd make on this, when you analyze this, is where the Israeli public puts itself. There's been a gradual, over, I'd say, the last couple of decades, rightward shift where the Israeli publics are. If you look at some of the polling around this, if you ask Israelis to self-identify, I think some of the numbers put you somewhere between 55 or 63%, depending on the polls you're looking at, 62% maybe, of those who self-identify as being on the right. But what that does is tell you something, especially relative to sort of 15% that I self-identify on the left. So that gives you some sense of the milieu and the context in which this election was taking place.
Could I just add, I agree with everything Lucy said. I think what's important is for the listeners to understand what, like, right, left, center mean in Israeli context. America, when we mean right and left, it's often about the role of a government in society, high taxes, low taxes. Over there, it's more about the question of territory to yield to Arabs, and do you really get peace if you yield territory or you don't? And I think what's fascinating to understand is kind of a realigned politics. Lucy made the point about how people self-identify on the right, and that when it comes to Israeli Jews, which are like up to 80% of the population, that number is like up to 63% of those self-identify that way. In 1992, the left of center parties were 56. In this election, they were 11. And what that tells you is not that Israel has become monochromatic all on the right, but that the debate is not about, is there going to be two-state solution tomorrow morning? It's about people in the center who are trying to say, look, we got to leave the door open to that possibility, because having that possibility is also what ensures the dual character of Israel as a democratic state and as a Jewish state, of course, with equal rights for all citizens, Jewish or not Jewish.
That's what the center is about, but we're seeing a rightward shift, as you said, Lucy, and that is somewhat dismaying to many American Jews who are concerned about this rightward shift. We heard Benjamin Netanyahu, prime minister, say before the election that he planned to possibly annex Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank, which could very much complicate, if not preclude, the creation of a Palestinian state. So we're talking about moves in addition to those declared by President Trump, the moving of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, the annexation of the Golan Heights. All of this is very adverse vis-a-vis the Palestinians. and could close off. So what about that possibility, and what does that say?
Yeah, I think that's correct, and that is one of the big questions I think everybody will be looking at. Netanyahu did make this statement saying that he would be open to or would annex all the settlements. He said that pre-election, sort of 11th hour pre-election, and now the question will be, will he go ahead and make that move? And I think there are a couple of things to look at when you analyze what the prospects of that are. Certainly, we have to look at what this coalition building process ends up looking like. It's about another, I believe we've got about another 6 weeks maximally until this would be sorted out. This coalition building process is where you see all the bargaining happening, all the different parties trying to get what they want out of the deal. And so this is very much something to look for, because the parties we are assuming will end up in this coalition would not be parties holding him back on annexation. To the contrary, Netanyahu might be the one who's most reluctant to do it, or at least that would have been the perspective looking at these in the past. So there's not going to be anyone in the coalition necessarily holding back from making good on that statement. The other question is what the U.S. role ends up being in that. In the past, again, a check on Israel moving in that direction has often been the U.S. administration. Netanyahu historically has been rather cautious himself, but often what he's been able to point to as well is the U.S. administration. Obviously, that relationship is very important to the U.S. administration, not wanting Israel to make certain moves. The question in the current climate, for many of the reasons that have already come up in your introduction and some of our comments, is that this has been a very friendly U.S. administration to this particular Israeli government. And so I think that's one of the other questions we have to look at. And of course, the big potential game changer here could be the long-awaited peace plan. We don't know what's in that peace plan. The sense that has been given by those who've been charged with writing it is that it is coming soon. Now, that's been being said for quite some time now, but there definitely has been a ratcheting up drumbeat, if you will, towards it's coming. It's going to come sometime after the Israeli elections. Jared Kushner had said publicly that it will now be after Ramadan. So that takes us to June. We don't know what's in that plan and what will the impact of that plan be on whether Netanyahu makes that move. And that's something we can maybe discuss further as well.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are David Makovsky. He's a distinguished fellow and director of the Project on Arab-Israel Relations at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Lucy Kurtzer-Ellenbogen, from whom you just heard. She's director of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict Program at the U.S. Institute of Peace. We're discussing the fallout and significance of the parliamentary elections in Israel. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Mustafa Mahmoud from Almania, Egypt, Masr. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Back to you, David Makovsky. Now, the United States has been very friendly, obviously, to the State of Israel, but the Palestinians see this as hostile. All of these moves do not militate in their favor, whether it was the move of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, the annexation of the Golan Heights, the announcement by Netanyahu that he may annex West Bank settlements. So even if a peace deal is rolled out, what makes anyone think that they would be willing to be a party to it if they have not been conferred with or all of these preemptive moves have been made?
No, it's a great question. Look, the United States has made three major efforts to end the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Bill Clinton's effort, Condoleezza Rice in 2007-08, sometimes called the Annapolis process. I was part of a third effort led by Secretary of State John Kerry and the Obama administration. These were three noble efforts, but the question is, why would the fourth one be different? And my fear is in the Middle East, whenever it's all or nothing, it's nothing. But we have a president who wrote a book, you know, The Art of the Deal, and sees that this would be like a crowning achievement of sorts to have pulled this off. Except for the president himself, I don't know if there's anyone else who believes that the time is propitious, that the Venn diagram on the five core issues, the borders, the security, Jerusalem, refugees, mutual recognition, that Venn diagram overlaps sufficiently between Netanyahu and Abbas. So I'm somewhat of a skeptic of the grand deal, but it should also be pointed out that the Palestinians don't want an incremental deal either. That's also part of the problem. They kind of welcome all or nothing, but they don't mind the nothing. So it's a difficult situation. I think something where you get the publics on both sides to stop being so skeptical and cynical, I think would be useful. If I could think of one thing that would take a lot of political courage on both sides to do, but would convince the other side that the other one is a partner and is actually sincere about trying to solve this, is imagine if Israel doesn't extend its settlement activity outside of its security barrier. 85% of those Israelis over the Green Line live in the 8% of the land adjacent to Israeli cities. But, you know, there's a relative number that live outside that barrier. So if you say you're not going to build there because we want to keep open the prospects of a two-state solution, or what if the Palestinians take an obligation on themselves not to give money to relatives of people who perpetrate violence? Each side could do one big thing that I think could impact the calculus of the public on the other side without going for the 5 for 5, which to me, these 5 core issues, they look like a long shot, given that there's a history on every one of these issues.
So Lucy Kurtzer, Ellen Bogan, is the two-state solution even still viable? Have these actions and even the rhetoric by the Trump administration to some extent foreclosed that? And I'm referring to the fact that even the Secretary of State refused to publicly endorse a two-state solution in a recent hearing on Capitol Hill.
I think there were a couple of questions baked in there, which is, one, is it still viable, which is slightly distinct from where are the leaders headed towards now? Where is the political will pointing to make it possible? So I think, as you note, the Trump administration has been very staunch on not saying two-state solution. They haven't ruled it out. They refuse to rule it affirmatively in. You've had a little bit of mixed messaging over time on that. You've had going back to Trump's initial one-state, two-state, whatever the parties want. Going to, personally, I think I prefer the two-state, but we'll see. And then recently, as you mentioned, Pompeo not saying directly that they will go that way. Annexation will certainly, as you say, if that happens, will change dramatically things on the ground. The question is, of these other steps that you mentioned, are some of these things reversible if the parties get to a point and the international community facilitating that, as it has played that role in the past, will they get back to the point of seeing that as the solution that they can negotiate towards that could lead to a sustainable agreement, in which case it is still possible. It gets harder with every passing year. And again, certainly annexation could be a game changer there. But I think, you know, David raised a few points to pick up on. He kept getting back to this lack of hope, lack of faith that each side has in there being a partner on the other side, public despair. That has only grown over time on both sides. You've seen this sort of disparity in numbers over the years of, yes, I support a two-state solution, but no, I don't believe it'll happen in my lifetime. And as David mentioned or alluded to, there is a cost. It's not cost-free to put out a plan and say, oops, that one didn't work again. Every time there's an active effort that fails, you see it in the numbers. Despair drops even further because now you're almost counting up the notches on the bedpost of there's another attempt that failed. And what it does is sort of harden this notion that, well, obviously the two-state solution itself is not viable, as opposed to perhaps looking at, well, is it the approach we're taking to try to get there? What are the mechanisms that we need to be looking at to help push us in that direction if that is indeed where the parties continue to find common ground where they could both mutually agree and negotiate around?
Back to you, David Makovsky, just on the U.S.-Israel relationship. We're seeing what some critics have characterized as a politicization of the U.S.-Israel relationship under President Trump, whether it's Mr. Trump or the vice president making false allegations, saying that the Democratic Party is anti-Semitic or anti-Israel, these kinds of things that people, you know, read and maybe don't question. Are you concerned about what appears to be more of a politicization of the relationship, the inflammatory rhetoric, and preemptive actions to some extent that are designed to weaken the Palestinians in this negotiating process?
Yeah, of course. There was always a consensus in the U.S. On this issue, and that consensus seems to have evaporated, and it might reflect the fact that you have polarization on the ground, too. And it's very hard to keep the two distinct. Actually, on the annexation issue that I think could inflame some of the divisions in the U.S., I tend to think that Netanyahu is not going to move on annexation without a U.S. green light. And he's not going to look for it even until after the peace plan collapses. He doesn't want to get out ahead of Trump. But the broader issue, I feel, is that the fragmentation in the U.S., I fear, will deepen if we don't find at least some measures of progress, because I am concerned at one point the Palestinians will throw in the towel and they will just say, we don't want a state, we want to vote. And that is something that, you know, will impact the DNA here in the United States. So there needs to be a way to avoid a binational state, which neither side says they want. Each one wants their own ethnic state. And I fear that the cost of failure is going to be that this debate is going to morph, and that could deepen divisions here in the U.S. as well.
And of course, Lucy, we have to say that we're in the midst of an election campaign. The Republicans are trying to tarnish their opponents, the Democrats, painting them as somehow anti-Semitic or anti-Israel, just because maybe a few have questioned maybe the wisdom of the current Israeli government. But nonetheless, many critics say that it is damaging because it undermines the bipartisanship that has always characterized the U.S.-Israeli relationship. Republicans and Democrats alike see the value of Israel as an ally, but don't necessarily give a green light or endorse all of the government's actions.
Yes, I mean, that's what you're seeing very much right now. And of course, the danger, maybe for want of a better word, of all these dynamics coming in the midst of as we're gearing up for an election campaign is you're only going to see this kind of attempts to politicize the issue in our U.S. domestic elections ratchet up, which I don't see, to say the least, being constructive for the aim that everybody's trying to get to, which is resolving this conflict.
And just quickly back to the elections. It's ironic, isn't it, David, that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict wasn't even really an issue, right, in the elections.
Right. Look, well, the nature of elections is always to go after that very limited floating voter. So they feel like 90% of the people are dug in either on the center block or the right block. I don't think that means these issues disappear, but ironically, Netanyahu, by making some of these hardline statements, not about modified annexations, but sweeping ones, ironically actually undercut some of these hard right parties, and they didn't make it into the parliament. So, I mean, I think for the most part, this was viewed as a referendum on Netanyahu's leadership. I think most people voted either right or center based on where they were on this big issue of relations with the Palestinians.
Do you agree, Lucy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that characterization, as David mentioned before, when people define as right or left and look at right and left wing, this is sort of the issue for which that is a prism. And this is not an issue, if you look, as you noted, it was really not an issue in the campaign. And I think that reflects, frankly, the fact that on a day-to-day basis, that is really not the issue that rises to the top of the Israelis' mind and concern, other than such as it relates to the broader overarching security concern. Of course, on the Palestinian side, it's much more of a daily occupation for them. That's why you have this sort of asymmetry, you will, this disparity between the pressure that both sides feel for something to change. And one of the challenges, I think it was mentioned before, that how long until the Palestinians start saying, just give me my vote. You're already seeing that trend when you speak to young Palestinians. Increasingly, I've noticed myself just sort of on the ground talking there to those over the last 5 years, this kind of growth in this notion of, we don't care about a state anymore. Give us a state, don't give us a state. We just want our rights and our dignity. And so these are the dynamics on the ground, which, again, if these play out too long without some movement forward, without some reasons on both sides for them to see hope, progress, and a political horizon for this conflict being able to be ended at some point, that's when you start to get concerned about when will something give.
An important topic for a future program. But for now, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, David Makovsky, Distinguished Fellow and Director of the Project on Arab-Israel Relations at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Lucy Kurtzer-Ellenbogen. She's Director of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict Program at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Thank you so much, both of you, for your keen insights.
Thank you
for having us on.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rob McLean. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.